No doubt that he was kind of skeptical about the real personality of Imam. The love for this authority and love for ruling the people that normally intrigues people to do actions against their own good judgment. So even if he knew, maybe he was not fair with himself.
Okay.
But there's a reality, no doubt that. He was planning in a way that you see that for it's a kind of a plot and a kind of
yes.
If you see the historical sequence of these things that if it was just knowing about the personality of Imam, he could have sessions with Imam and solve his intellectual problems. But
yes.
I think there was a plot, mm-hmm. and in some of the narrations which we read, we find that, for example, with the theologian of Khorasan, and he was named, I think, Sulaiman or Salman.
Yes.
He asks him and tells him that only for once I want you to overcome Imam. For once.
Uh-huh.
Why? And to prove that he's infallible. He's a person like us. He said, only one time I want you to overcome him.
Okay.
Just a question, just a problem, just a, any matter,
subject, yes.
That says, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
For one stance of
and
his,
he was not
to
successful.
Prove that he's infallible. And it was to show that the normal people, the ordinary people, the Muslims generally, that this is like us. This the personality you are loving and this sacred personality you think that the progeny of Prophet is infallible. He want to prove practically that this is the wrong idea. So it was for himself, it was a very intelligent plan to bring every time a new scholar to prove that Imam was... the result was totally وَمَكَرُوا وَمَكَرَ اللَّهُ وَاللَّهُ خَيْرُ الْمَاكِرِينَ.
Yes.
And the result was against him. The,
yes.
the more he brought scholars, the more the aspects of the great knowledge and
yes.
the ethical and spiritual and intellectual aspects of Imam were becoming more clear to people. So in one of the sayings, Imam also himself mentions this, that actually I am dealing with the multi-layer things. So in one, there is the political thought,
yes.
and there is the intellectual scenario where there are many disputes and new disputes are coming into the Muslim world. So Imam was dealing with both of them. Imam was trying to deal with the plot which Mamun had, and also to guide people in the right way.
That's all right.
So
that's very good. Very good, Brother Sajjad had a nice elaboration. Thank you very much. But what were the main topics, the themes of these debates, Brother Said Mohsen?
Well, obviously, there were no main topics, we can see, obviously, because the first dialogue which was happened, Mamun al-Rashid has called four different, the people from four different religions.
Religions, okay.
Like the Christians, the Jews, and there were other groups who were called, and they were asked to do debate with Imam. And it was general. So basically, as brother has mentioned, it was a matter that any topic can be discussed in that, obviously, session. And the only thing they want to hear is that he should say, I don't know. So we cannot say generally it was the main theme. But obviously, on the other hand, we see it because it was between different religions, among different religions. So the main topic was, we can say, about God,
mm-hmm.
that who is God, or maybe, why Christians, they believe that, for example, Jesus is the Son of God, whereas
okay,
Muslims
Trinity.
Believe, yes,
yes,
the Muslim believes that he's the prophet. And similarly with others was the same thing.
That's all right. And is it true that Imam answered their questions according to their own books? For example, the Old Testament and the New Testament. So it shows Imam's mastery over these languages, especially Hebrew language, isn't it?
Well, obviously, the history tells us that the Imam has answered everyone from their own book.
Uh-huh.
From their own resources, and this is the way we do dialogue. The dialogue doesn't mean that, for example, if I'm a Muslim, I'm doing a dialogue with a Christian, I bring proofs from the Quran and he brings
uh-huh.
proof from the Bible. That is not the way of doing dialogue. The dialogue is in a way that you prove something from their own book.
Okay.
For example, if I want someone to believe in Islam, I need to bring proofs from their book.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want me to become Christian, for example, or Jew, they need to bring something from the Quran, as this is happening today, obviously, when the dialogues are happening. So basically, this is true. That's the first thing. The second thing is, obviously, when we talk about the knowledge of Imam, they have the ilm or the knowledge which has been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
Which is known as ilm al-ladunni, which has been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So they do not have this ordinary knowledge that we have. Mm-hmm. And the difference is, when we talk about the knowledge, we are gaining knowledge.
Yes.
We come to this world
to acquire knowledge. Born,
we acquire knowledge. Yes. We spend some time in learning alphabets, for example, and then the other things. Whereas the imams, when we talk about them, the ilm is been given to them. It is something which is in them. Mm-hmm. And they do have the knowledge of it, and we believe that.
Especially in the modern world, when you talk about such themes, it is very much difficult to understand what does it mean by ilm al-ladunni, I mean the God-given knowledge. And it, because the people usually think that the type of knowledge we are talking about is the science in the laboratories, but it is not. Yeah. I mean the nature and the, the very nature of such type of knowledge is very much different.
It's not hard to believe because, you know, in the prophets, even we see like Jesus, the prophet Jesus, alayhi salam, when he came in front of, you know, the people, when Lady Mary, salamu alayhi, she brought.
Yes.
So he started to talk.
Yes.
Like, I am the prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'm the abd of Allah, servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and I've been sent to you.
In the cradle. Yes.
Yeah. So we have all these things. There are many other examples in the history. So when we refer to the history, we find all these stories, and these are the true.
That's right.
History, that no one has denied it.
And you know, Ma'mun al-Abbasi and the Abbasis were famous to create the golden age of the science and knowledge. But all of a sudden, an imam who is under the control, under the supervision, and is not a man from the laboratory, is a man from the lineage of Prophet Muhammad, comes and answers all the questions on theology, the history of religion, Trinity, and this and that. So this must be a real big disgrace for Ma'mun al-Abbasi, isn't it?
Yeah, no doubt that there's a lot of difference, a clear difference between a person with a materialistic perspective about the life and the world, and who has based his own activities, whether they are knowledge-related or whether they are his related to his action, is based on the materialistic goals, with a person who has not limited himself to just the materialistic aspect. A person who is related in one aspect, he is related to the divinity, to the God. He has a higher level of spiritual relation with Allah. And ethically, he has the greatest qualities of moral excellences.
Yes.
And in practice, he is a role model for action, for good deeds. So such a personality is totally different. It's actually, for if you go to the mentality and psychology of such people who want to have the hegemony and rule the world, they see such personality as a challenge for themselves.
Okay.
He sees that there is a person, he is more wise than me, he's spiritually more powerful than me, he rules the hearts of people.
That's
and
right.
How he that it's the irony of the history, you know, that we come to the such rulers who have the this dream of becoming the role model for whole universe and human society, and then they come with when they see such personalities like Imam Raza alayhi salam. So that envy works here, and the hatred which results in the result of their envy towards such personality, instead of being having submission to such personalities and giving them place to guide humanity towards their goals, they try to fight them. And that's an irony of history, that
that's
always
right.
the kings and the people of power were acting with the prophets in such a negative way. So it's
They say that the tomb of Imam al-Raza alayhi salam and Harun al-Rashid are in the same place. Mm-hmm. But see nowadays who is visiting who.
Yeah.
The people go to visit Imam al-Raza alayhi salam and not Harun al-Rashid with his greatest palace. You know that he was one of the greatest Abbasid kings and his son Ma'mun al-Abbasi. You know, they had really big empire, but they are not remembered today. Imam Reza alayhi salam is remembered today. People in the city of Mashhad, called Merv or Khorasan at that time, you know, they go there, they pay visit over there. And the soul of such people like the imams really is helpful to them today in a very positive way.
Sorry to interrupt you. Even Quran has cited such a thing. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ سَيَجْعَلُ لَهُمُ الرَّحْمَنُ وُدَّ. It's a reality. It's a reality that someone who is embarked on the journey of submission to Allah, and he's embarked on the path of faith and good deeds, Allah says, I will put his love and the attraction towards him in hearts of people.
Very good.
So in all the history, if you see that we have philosophers in the history, we have reformists, we have different influential personalities in the history, but at the end, when you see after the centuries, even now, the one who is ruling on the hearts of people is the personalities like Imam Rida alayhi salam, the prophets.
That's right.
So
there is a famous quote by his father, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, referring to his son Ali, and says that your brother Ali ibn Musa is the most knowledgeable among the progeny of the prophet, you know. And this really, and as I said, I think in other programs, believing in Imam Reza alayhi salam means that you believe in 12 imams, because there is no denomination or we can say Shiite sect created after Imam Reza alayhi salam. So he is really the missing link in these chains of imamate. It shows the great position of this holy imam. We have the chance of having this imam and his holy shrine in our country, Islamic Republic of Iran, in Mashhad. And today is the birthday anniversary of Imam Reza alayhi salam. May Allah give us the chance of paying the visit and homage to the city of Mashhad and the holy shrine and holy chamber of Imam Reza alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you talking about the debates of Imam Reza alayhi salam with the followers of other religions. We would like to express again our congratulations on the birthday anniversary of Imam Reza alayhi salam. If you got a chance and paid a visit to the city of Mashhad and Imam Reza Holy Shrines, do not forget us in your prayers and supplications. For more information on this program and to download for free our other episodes of this program, you can visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Assalamu alaikum, Ya Ali ibn Musa Reza.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن.
Aperture.
Dow Chemical and DuPont are American chemical corporations. These two chemical giants have become the number one companies in the chemical sector. Today, they make billions of euros in profit, but behind this resounding success lies a dark secret: toxic contamination and pollution, which has affected thousands, causing disabilities, cancers, and even death. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For decades, Dow Chemical and DuPont factories have been secretly dumping their toxic waste into rivers, groundwater systems, and soil, and keeping the tragic consequences a secret. Sadly, the constant exposure to toxic waste spares no one, neither surrounding residents nor the company's employees. Stay with us as this week's documentary sheds light over years of lies and impunity through the analysis of samples and confidential documents.
This is home.
see who's used to be up in there. Keep an eye. Get out of the head.
At the end of the 60s, Leotis Jones was a prisoner in Holmesburg, a suburb of Philadelphia in the United States. A prisoner, but also a guinea pig for industry, like thousands of other inmates.
H-Block, this is where all the medical tests and the human experimentation was going on.
How many times have you taken that corridor?
Oh, man, about maybe 25, 30 times. You know, but there was different tests that they was running. And sometimes I was on like two tests at a time, you know?
Okay.
This practice was confidential at the time, because multinational chemical companies came here to test the risks of their products. To earn a few dollars, the prisoners participated in several tests, but none of them knew what they were being given.
What they would do, they would put the tape and stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it. Then they would put a drop in the substance, whatever it was that was in it, on that area.
And what happened after?
All over my body, my skin pigmentation got light in certain areas.
How long did it last?
About a year, somewhere around there. And they had you signing a paper stating that it was informed consent, but it was just a paper to waive them from being liable if anything go wrong.
One company did everything they could to keep this a secret. They even paid Leotis Jones for his silence. Dow Chemical. The leading manufacturer of plastics in the world and the third largest manufacturer of pesticides, Dow Chemical has an annual turnover of $48 billion and 50,000 employees around the globe. In the wake of this chemical giant, there's an industry of staggering profitability. An industry in a frantic race to innovate. Each year, their new toxic products reach the market. These multinationals all have one thing in common, a culture of secrecy.
You're following us.
Polluting lands, rivers, and groundwater. Behind the fumes of these factories, we have discovered tens of thousands of victims. In India, children are born with severe disabilities. In the U.S., those who have dedicated their lives to this industry...
Everybody won't go there because of, for the money, for the benefits, it was secure.
...are now paying the price.
Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. Why'd they lie?
Faced with these tragedies, the chemical giants have adopted a specific course of action. Lack of transparency... Cynicism, denial. In the meantime, they continue to reap the profits. In Holmesburg Prison, Dow experimented on the inmates with one of the most carcinogenic products in the world, dioxin. It's one of the molecules in Agent Orange, the powerful herbicide that Dow produced for the American Army during the Vietnam War. The Air Force dumped it on the Viet Cong for a decade. At the same time, the tests were being performed at Holmesburg. From that time on, Dow was already aware of the dangers of dioxin. The company put it in writing in this confidential note from June 1965. Dioxin is exceptionally toxic. Some months later, Dow would study its side effects on the prisoners.
Hey, man, what can I say? There's no way in the world if they would inform us back then that we would participate. No. No, no, I wouldn't have. They were trying to cover it up. They wouldn't invite it now.
We found one of the doctors that performed the tests at Holmesburg in the 1960s. Today, he's an oncologist at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago.
Hi, Sigmund Weitzman is preparing to retire. He is one of the few witnesses still alive.
Every day, I had a row of 20 convicts. They were coming in all day. Okay. So
all day long, people were coming.
Oh, absolutely. It was a machine.
In 1967, Sigmund Weitzman was only 21 years old. He was an intern at Holmesburg. The senior physician overseeing the tests never told him the names of the products used on the prisoners. He only realized later that he had administered dioxin to human beings. We show him what Dow knew back then about the chemical.
This material is exceptionally toxic. No wonder it's confidential. This is 50 years old.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting.
This is the first time you read these documents?
Yes.
I'm
appalled. I'm just very... It's so casual. I also felt personally guilty that I was participating in something so horrible. You don't give people poison. It's just simple. You know, as if these people aren't people. They're just experimental animals. Nowadays, it would be criminal.
Dow was never prosecuted. When prisoners tried to take action against the company, the statute of limitations had expired. This multinational would not only poison inmates with dioxin, but also tens of thousands of people in Midland, Michigan, in the north of the U.S. Midland, the birthplace of Dow.
Here at the Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, revolutionary chemical killers.
This is where Agent Orange was manufactured. Its production created waste extremely high in dioxin. Dow secretly dumped this waste into the river that flows through the city. In 1981, one man would discover the truth.
We had a conclusion there that Dow was a major source, if not the only source, to the river, and certainly to the community, and that people were at risk.
At the time, Milton Clark was a toxicologist for the EPA, the government agency responsible for environmental protection. With his colleagues, he wrote a report condemning Dow's practices. But right before the report's publication, the corporation would succeed in pressuring the acting chief of the EPA in Washington. Pressured by his superiors, Milton Clark was forced to censor the report. The result? Pollution in Midland, Michigan would continue for 30 years with impunity. And the executives at Dow would continue denying the dangers.
There is no health problem in Midland. There is absolutely no evidence of dioxin doing any damage to humans.
In 2006, one woman would attack the multinational again. At the time, Mary Gade oversaw all the offices at the Environmental Agency in the Midland region. She had leverage. She'd been nominated by the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Newly appointed, she demands that more testing be done in the city.
We found these astronomically high levels of dioxin, levels that my staff think may be some of the highest levels ever found in the United States. One of the things that was astonishing to me when this came to my attention was that for almost 30 years, this very serious problem had not actually been addressed.
Where have you found these high levels?
So yeah, we found it in yards alongside the river system, parks where children play, where people launch their boats, where fishermen put their boats in the water. This is where people live. So I immediately called Dow senior officials and said, we're very concerned about these levels. We need you to take action. As that unfolded, the company was not happy. It's extremely expensive to clean up this much contamination, mm-hmm. Hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more.
To lodge a complaint, Dow goes directly to the White House.
I was asked on May 1st of 2008 to either resign or quit by the end of the day.
Okay. Were you surprised?
Yes, very much so. In my 30-some years of working in environmental protection and much of that spent in the government, I would have never expected that. Dow was acting in its own interest, so Dow was trying to make sure that it saved as much money as possible.
As a result of these maneuvers, for decades, thousands of people have lived surrounded by dioxin without knowing the risks. We wanted to meet these victims. But in Midland, it's hard to loosen tongues. Dow has supported the city for 120 years, and reminders are at every corner. At the bank, the stadium, the library, the public park, the high school. The shadow of the company is everywhere. Only one person agreed to break the code of silence. Alice Buchelter has spent most of her life here, near the river. This is where she raised her family.
Oh, this is where we used to have the zip line way back here.
Okay.
We used to have all trails that went down through here. I don't even know if you can see any of them over here. But 18 years and the land is very fertile, and it was used for motocross trails and hiking trails and dune buggy trails and just, you know, recreation in the woods. For a kid, it was like a wonderland. It was, you know, an adventure. They could explore, and they could build forts, and they could do all those things.
No one advised you that there was dioxin down there?
We just thought we found a magical spot for us to play and raise a family.
For nearly 40 years, the Buchelter family would live here, blissfully unaware of their toxic surroundings. Every spring, the river floods their garden, bringing in a fresh wave of dioxin. Alice Buchelter would not discover the true extent of the contamination until 2007. When tests were conducted in her garden by the local environmental agency, the levels of dioxin were up to 17 times higher than the legal limit for toxicity.
I have, my oldest daughter has autoimmune diseases.
You have 5 kids?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them do have autoimmune disease?
I would say all of them. Some to a lesser degree, and some to a more severe degree. And my husband had a very malignant colon cancer. It was a real quick onset.
Her late husband, Herbert Buchelter, was a doctor. A few days before he passed away, he expressed a last wish.
He was brave enough to, when he was dying, to have his blood drawn when he didn't have very much blood left. Dioxin levels were taken the Thursday before he died on a Sunday. He was willing to do it to ascertain that there was a connection. The results of my husband's, this is his levels.
These are the actual breakdown.
Alex Buchelter's husband had 64.5 nanograms of dioxin per liter of blood, 3 times the U.S. average.
We had been married 46 years when he died. And and would I have treasured 10 more years? Yeah. And, you know, that's been a major impact on my life.
The American Environmental Agency has finally forced Dow to clean the river. But the process has only just begun. It could take decades and cost hundreds of millions of dollars. However, no date is set for decontaminating neighboring yards like Alice Buchelter's. Dow refused all our requests for an interview. The multinational merely sent us an email stating that we seek science-based solutions that protect human health while also contributing to the well-being of the local community. On the other side of the world, another contamination is wreaking havoc. As a result of one of the worst industrial catastrophes in history, thousands of children have been affected. But Dow has never dealt with it. It happened in India, in Bhopal. In 1984, the local chemical plant exploded, killing 20,000 people and releasing tons of toxic products. At the time, the factory belonged to Union Carbide, a pesticide giant that Dow would buy up in 2001. The site of the Bhopal explosion is still saturated with chemical pollution. Over the years, these products have spread into the city's groundwater systems. For 15 years, the inhabitants have demanded a full decontamination. In vain, Dow refuses to act. The decaying steel site is still accessible today. Here we meet Mr. Xuan, a former engineer. At the time, he was in charge of the storage of the chemicals in this laboratory.
There's so many chemicals still remaining in this quality control lab. Very few bottles are now at present. But after the disaster, this quality control lab was full of the chemicals, bottle, drums, and after 32 years, still they are lying.
Is that dangerous?
Yeah, it is dangerous because there's no proper care of these premises.
Among the products stored in the factory, there was lindane, an extremely toxic insecticide. Today it is forbidden all over the world. According to our guide, the soil surrounding the factory is full of it.
The whole area is highly contaminated. They are dumping all toxic waste effluent on the ground. Right now you can feel the smell of the benzene hexachloride on this spot. And it is dangerous to stay here for a long period.
Benzene hexachloride is the scientific name for lindane. We go down to the area of the spill to take some samples. The smell is unbearable. We'll have the soil analyzed. Just before leaving, Mr. Xuan shows us where the pesticides were made. Beads of mercury lie exposed in the open air. According to the World Health Organization, this is one of the top 10 most dangerous chemical products in the world. We take some more samples. The results of our two tests are astonishing. Inside the factory, the level of mercury is 5 million times higher than the environmental standard. At this level of concentration, the risks of developing liver, skin, or lung cancers are considerable. The levels of lindane are just as alarming, exceeding 100,000 times the standard level. This can provoke severe cases of cerebral degeneration. Yet only 20 meters away, we see children playing cricket on the contaminated ground. The chemical contamination stretches far beyond the walls of the factory. Toxic waste has penetrated the land and has polluted the water of many neighborhoods. Up to 3 kilometers from the factory, 50,000 people live there. We went to take water samples to identify the molecules present in their wells. Like in Shakya's family home, they've lived in the house for almost 30 years. The water they consume contains 1.9 micrograms of mercury per liter, 2 times the standard level of toxicity. The problem is, even in boiled water, mercury is still carcinogenic. In other areas of Bhopal, it's not mercury, but lindane that wreaks havoc on human lives. This is a problem in Preetnagar, a neighborhood situated 1 kilometer away from the factory. The municipality has had drinkable water since 2011, but for many years, the inhabitants have been drinking severely polluted water. That's the case for Rukmani and her 13-year-old daughter, Rachna. Since her birth, she's suffered from limited mental development and muscular dystrophy. She can neither talk nor stand up by herself. Rukmani, her mother, drank contaminated water every day during her pregnancy. A few months after Rashna's birth, a governmental study was conducted in the area. The levels of lindane were extremely high in the water, 17 times the World Health Organization limit. Due to her disabilities, Rashna has never been able to go to school. Every day she comes to the Shingari Rehabilitation Center. Without these daily exercises, she would be completely paralyzed today. Rashida B. is the founder of the center. She has watched all these children grow up.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights, and there's a claim made by the champions, if I can call them, of human rights, where they pride themselves in saying, well, we have advocated human rights and we have applied to human rights, and we have human rights, thus we are better than the rest, right? Now, we cannot accept this claim made by them. While the bitter reality of the African and Asian nations and the hungry millions of human beings, we can see them before our eyes and watch the constant spectacle of violations that is being done to humans around the world, or at least of several nations where it is direct violation. Those who have been outspoken in advocating human rights during at least the last 40 years have themselves grabbed the most fundamental of human rights from people of what they called the third world countries. And now that term self is a problem. When you classify yourself as a first world country and you classify the rest as second world countries and the rest are third world countries, that's a problem itself. That's an indication that human rights has not been done. If you want to advocate human rights, it has to be advocated for everybody. You can't just advocate it for your own people, for your own nation, and pride yourself into that and let the world suffer. That is not a human look towards things. Now, when we look at Imam Ali alayhi salam and we looked at how he defined human beings, either brother in faith or equal in humanity, that he was taken into consideration that you just can't be selfish enough to only worry about yourself and make sure that you yourself, your rights have been met, while the rights of millions of people and billions of people around the world is being deprived. Now, that's not a human look, to say the least. I wouldn't say Islamic. It's not a human look. Because as humans, we were meant to care for one another. It is within the convenience that certain governments and regimes that deny men and women their most primary rights have managed to survive. They look at these governments, if this government is within their lines and giving them the support they require, or as Trump puts it clearly, as long as they are a cow that they can milk, then they will turn a blind eye to whatever oppression that these countries are doing, which is a problem. I mean, you can't advocate human rights and then support the dictators of today's world. And also, you try to deprive some nations from within, or try to break it from within and deprive it from its all of its sources. That's a double face, or that's what we call hypocrisy. Either you want to advocate it for every human being and try to make sure that you, as a nation that puts itself in the state of policing the world, that you make sure that every government is doing the right thing towards the people, or don't advocate it to begin with. You say, you know what, I don't care about the world, I care about my people, and that's all I know. And then that I can accept. But to advocate human rights and never apply it to others, then that is hypocrisy to its best. Let us take a short break, and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Now, when we are talking about human rights and the champions of human rights, even though this is a false claim, when they see people, even with in their own systems, advocating for the real human rights. So, for example, we have journalists, we have outspoken, educated people and thinkers. When they go public and they try to expose these systems and bring their true realities to people, those people themselves, they get prosecuted, they get killed, they get assassinated. And we can see that today, even in the news, where a lot of journalists have been executed. And why is that? Because they're trying to educate people that in this particular region, where human rights seems to be, you know, the norm, or the country or the system seems to claim that they are, you know, taking care of humans. But when the true news comes out to the public, the true reality comes to the public, the true face comes to the public, they find these people a source of threat, and they get killed. And sometimes, not only in their own countries, but even outside their countries. So if they see, for example, a person who advocates human rights, a person who speaks about oppression, a person who tried to bring news to the outside world, these people get prosecuted. Now, to give you an example, we have Julian Assange, an Australian citizen, the creator and the founder of WikiLeaks, when he tried to bring documents that proves a lot of violations have been done, either by the American government or by the Western governments, and it shows their true nature. Now, he gets imprisoned. They fabricate an accusation on him. They put him in jail, and he's been in jail for many, many years now, and even without a trial. And you know, he might even die in jail because his health is not that well. So we see that if a person wants to bring out the news to the outside world from the same countries who claim to be the champions of human rights and the advocates of human rights, they violate that, which indicates to us that the human race has reached a point of no return when it comes to how selfish they could get and how uncaring they could become towards their fellow human beings. And they just do not care about them. They only care about themselves. And now we have this mentality that it says, care about number one, which is you. Anyone else It is absolutely not your problem. And that itself is a fundamental mistake and error that Islam fights from the beginning. Any human being who has this kind of mentality, Islam rejects it. The Quran rejects it. The teachings of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt reject such an idea and such a mentality. Actually, it should be the opposite. It should be Islam advocates for everybody. Islam wants its members, it wants its followers to advocate human rights for everyone. And no matter who the person is, if he violates human rights, he should be prosecuted. Unlike what we see in today's world. Now, we'll leave it here and we will catch up with you in another episode. So thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah the Kind. Dear brothers and sisters, salamu alaikum. You are listening to this program, Lantern, from IRIB English Radio. On the continuation of Lantern, we'll listen to an interesting story. Steve Jobs dies a billionaire with a fortune of $7 billion at the age of 56 from pancreatic cancer, and these are his last words. At this moment, lying on the bed, sick and remembering all my life, I realize that all my recognition and wealth that I have is meaningless in the face of imminent death. You can hire someone to drive a car for you, make money for you, but you cannot rent someone to carry the disease for you. As we get older, we are smarter, and we slowly realize that a watch is worth $30 or $300, both of which show the same time. Whether we drive a car worth $150,000 or a car worth $2,000, the road and distance are the same. We reach the same destination. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin astain. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with the truth of death. As we know, death is a natural phenomenon. I mean, there's no living thing that can avoid or escape death. Death comes to all living things. This is a natural rule. This is a rule of life in the whole world. There's a saying in the Persian language that can be translated in such bolatasiya hiranginist. There's any darker color than black. It means that there isn't anything beyond death, or death is the ultimate reality. We find that people are instinctively and naturally inclined to find the lives to be quite meaningful. No sane individual wants to live a meaningless life or to be wandering around here and there. Not physically, but psychologically, but from the point of intellection and the intellectual aspect of one's life. So we find that those people who are really very attentive to their lives and who believe that are coming into this world hasn't been quite haphazard or, for example, by chance. Rather, we are expected to have a set goal in front of ourselves. That is, everybody is expected to live a meaningful life. Imagine the lives of great people in any community. Some people have been renowned because of, for example, having made great mathematicians, great medical doctors, great engineers, and so on. Or, for example, even great artists. Okay. When we read the biographies and more than the, kinds of relations with others, with their peers in the communities, when we study the notes or, for example, the reflections, we find that they've had a very high aim in their lives, and toward those high aims they have moved. And one of the products or some of the byproducts of having a meaningful life has been, for example, a man or a woman has made a high ranking, a top ranking, and quite respectful personality.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Imagine the lives of, for example, great chemists, great physicists, or great, for example, medical doctors, mathematicians, or artists, and so on. Okay, you find that everybody wants to live forever. And one of the great manifestations of being remembered even after one's death is that throughout one's lifetime, a person does everything in order to leave something of his own fame on the ground, something quite tangible. If you take a trip to some other countries, you find that in some streets you find the small statues of some great people. And usually the names or date of birth and date of death and the field of expertise. Okay, these items are indicated somewhere in the lower part of the statue. Now you find that, these great people, for example, someone was a great chemist, someone was a great, for example, mathematician and so on. You find that all of them have remained, all of them intended to remain immortal, but as are, our biological life cannot go eternal, so we have to leave something behind which is more stable, which is expected to remain many, many years, even centuries after our death. Because of this, we find that great people have accomplished very important tasks. According to Lev Tolstoy, the Russian literary figure, this kind of background noise makes him think that, is there any meaning in my life that cannot be deteriorated, cannot be made meaningless through death? Leopardi, in this context, indicates that whatever has always made me preoccupied is that will there be any kind of high aim beyond idleness that death wouldn't deteriorate, wouldn't shock? Now you find that in order to remain eternal, or in order to live an eternal life, or in order to live in such a condition that even centuries after our death, our name is remembered with great respect, quite respectfully, by the sages, if not by the lay people, is because we accomplish very great tasks in our lives. For example, please note carefully that many great literary figures or scientists lived in this world, okay? We may not know, even today, quite readily, too many points about the highlights of their lives, yet we always benefit from the invention or from the contribution to human life or the contribution to knowledge. Imagine that, for example, we always remember Louis Pasteur, the French scientist, or, for example, Michael Faraday, who discovered electricity, or others, for example. Thank you very much.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ana bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu al-qulub.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A former head of Israeli regime's Mossad spy agency was deported from the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2019 after it emerged that he was involved in a plot to overthrow the country's president. During his visit to the DRC, the top Mossad spy was accompanied by Israeli oligarch Dan Gertler, who is involved in looting Congo's mineral resources, such as cobalt, while indigenous people are languishing in poverty. A Congolese professor elaborates here on how plundering by capitalists such as Gertler has destroyed the country. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on Israeli regime's destabilization activities in Africa. The Tel Aviv regime dispatched its top spy to the Democratic Republic of Congo to plan a coup against a democratically elected government. So why is the Tel Aviv regime